This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of ZCNYC. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ZCNYC. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, Sangha. Today I'd like to bring in something, a poem by Jalaluddin Rumi called The Guest House, which I was sent. The Guest House. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. They may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a god, as a guide, maybe a god, from beyond. So a teaching from Rumi about, I don't know, I took it in as being a bodhisattva to ourself, an apprentice bodhisattva in a fleeting world. Be grateful for whoever, whatever comes in as a guide. For those of you who are new, we hear this word bodhisattva a lot. We'll chant the bodhisattva vows at the end. So one who opts, one who chooses to stay in samsara, in the world of confusion, in the burning world, the rounds of suffering, helping to alleviate and free ourself and all beings from confusion, from suffering, and who realizes that awakening can only occur in the matrix of our connections. So you're all bodhisattvas, or reluctant bodhisattvas. I see myself sometimes as a very reluctant bodhisattva apprentice. Like Chuck Berry said, sometimes I will, but then again, I think I won't. From Rockin' and Reelin'. Sometimes I will, but then again, I think I won't. Yeah, so I think we all have this aspiration to turn towards those who are suffering. Sometimes we almost reach our aspiration, even in ourselves, and sometimes we fall short. And sometimes we hear a voice in us, at least I do, that says, run while you can. And so this too is part of the bodhisattva way, the reluctant bodhisattva. But we consciously set forth on the bodhisattva path. When we do, we vow to not turn away from suffering and not wait for special conditions. And that's a big one, right? These special conditions, or that because we think that what we are right now isn't good enough or enough to be of service, and how off that is, how wrong that is. I like to read the Jataka tales. I don't know if any of you read them. They're the tales of the Buddha's previous lives, before he was the Buddha, when he was an ordinary being. And what I really appreciate and sometimes look for to get guidance from is when he's in his hot hell realms, when he's not so nice, perhaps, or learning to be a bodhisattva. He's reluctant. actually, to step out and help. And I want to just see what that story kind of, how I can relate to that when I feel that kind of feeling. So there's this one story where he was forced to pull a chariot through fires. And he became extremely distressed over the struggles of his companion who was pulling the chariot as well and was quite feeble and weak. And suddenly this great compassion, seeing this companion struggling, welled up in his heart. And that was new for him, that feeling of feeling another in such a way. And it was said that that story was the first time bodhicitta, that aspiration to feel and to really feel the awakened heart mind that wants to meet that suffering being. And that dawned on his mind and became the beginning of his lifelong journey to awakening great compassion. And so it arised when can arise even when we're in hell. He was in hell in that moment. And that's what he noticed. He was definitely concerned with his own situation, but he felt someone else. So these stories show that when we're in our suffering, wherever we happen to find ourselves, even if it's hell, like, can we hold on to that aspiration of what this is about in a way? You know, the Buddha said, I'm here to teach one thing. It's about, all my teachings are about suffering and the cessation. Every teaching I've given is to address that noble truth. All of it comes down to that. So to have that in us, in our realms, and remind and remember, okay, this is to alleviate suffering. This is to alleviate mine and others. Can we hold that in every action? And you might be saying inside, what? What are you talking about? We're in hell. And we hold the aspiration to relieve suffering. What gives this hell being, this being in hell, the right to help others? No way. No way. No way can I be of benefit in this state. I'm a hot mess. I need to be wise and enlightened. I often hear people say that I can't really do much. I'm in such a hell realm. I'm in such a mess. I'm so messy. And for my own hot messes, in that rawness, there's actually so much wisdom and light that can be offered. So much wisdom. If we can hold that aspiration at the same time, we're in hell. And it actually shines through only in that circumstance, which is why we can help. If we don't know it, if we haven't been in that realm, then it's very hard to feel another who's also burning, right? So there's a lot of wisdom and light there. So don't be so quick, you know, to clean it all up. Or can't wait to have a better vision. Did you ever have that? A better vision of ourselves. When I'm out of this, I'll be so much ba 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 ba. And it's just so filled with pressure to me. The moment of being better then. It's like how we misunderstand perfection and we don't let ourselves live because we have this ideal being in mind that we're somehow going to do this and we're going to be like walking around like what? So we have to draw that back and be who we are and to honor. I love that word, honor. Honor, what does he say? Treat each guest honorably, each visit to us. They may be clearing you out for some new delight. So in that mess, with that honor and respect for what's going on, not turning our feelings into weapons, we might receive some new insight, some new delight. And that can always be offered. Pema Chodron wrote, "The mindset of samsara is that we can only be happy if we were someone other than the present self." That's the mindset of samsara. Somehow, someday, somewhere, some way, different. Perhaps then, she has dot, dot, dot. And we all have those thoughts of what we would do if we were just different in some way than we are. And the way that suddenly distances us from what's here, from what's actually Dharma, truth, truth. Here we are completely intertwined with everything and anyone. So our whatever state we're in, that's actually connected to everyone and everything. So even bodhisattvas become discouraged and reluctant sometimes. Many Mahayana sutras speak of inviting all sentient beings as our guests. When we invite a guest, how that is for us, when you invite a guest, we have a sense of the importance of that relationship. We're inviting something in. Our thoughts, our karma, a guest. And of course, in Zazen, we get a lot of guests. Our whole family shows up in Zazen. All our relatives, all the things we don't want, all the things we want. Lots of guests come and drink by the still pool. Lots of wild animals come into the forest to drink by the still pool. Everyone sits with us at some time. And so the bodhisattva, having that aspiration that this is to relieve suffering, can invite and address everyone that comes, everything that comes, with that attitude as a transient guest in a transient world. Because guests leave, right? They'll leave at some point. He says, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house of its furniture. Still treat each guest honorably. Why not? Why not honor? Where has the fight gotten us if we are mean in our meanness? There's a story that's pretty famous by Milarepa. As he faces the visitors in his cave, I should have it. Yeah. And this is how Milarepa, a Tibetan practitioner, he went off, he did some awful things in his life. And at one point, as his teacher worked with him quite a bit, you can read the story. I mean, nearly didn't survive. That's how how deep his remorse and atonement was in his life. And he worked with this teacher. And at one point he was ready for this solo retreat in the cave. And this is how he welcomed and entertained and treated his honorable house guests. One evening, Milarepa returned to his cave after gathering firewood, only to find it filled with demons. So we can just say, we just went to the grocery store and we came home and we're like taking our food out and suddenly we're filled with demons inside us. They were cooking his food, reading his books, sleeping in his bed. They had taken over the joint. He knew about non-duality of self and other, but he still didn't quite know how to get these guys out of his cave. Even though he had the sense that they were just a projection of his own mind, all the unwanted parts of himself, he didn't know how to get them out. First, he taught them the Dharma. You know, sometimes we put that on top of what we're experiencing. You know, we've got a demon come and saying, hey, I want to tell you something. We're like, Avalokiteshvara. Sometimes that's not the remedy. He sat on his seat that was higher than they were, and he said things to them about how we were all one. Yeah, done that, right? He talked about compassion and shunyata, emptiness, and how poison is medicine. Nothing happened. Demons are still there, right? We know we've had these conversations with ourselves. Then he lost patience and got angry and ran at them. They just laughed at him. Finally, he gave up and just sat down on the floor saying, I'm not going away, and it looks like you're not either. So let's just live here together. At that point, all of them left except for one. You know that one? Milarepa said, oh, this one is particularly vicious. So we know that one. Sometimes we have a lot of them like that. And sometimes it's feel that's we've all we've got is this one vicious demon. And he didn't know what to do. So he surrendered himself even further. He walked over and he put himself right into the mouth of the demon and said, just eat me up if you want to. Just eat me up if you want to. And that demon left too. You should try that. It actually works really well. Just surrender. Just eat me up if you want to. Go ahead. It's like that violently sweeping your house empty of your furniture. It takes it all away. How can we apprentice bodhisattvas not be overwhelmed and paralyzed to face the magnitude of the ways we are encouraged to turn to distraction with things that alter our mind? And we know them. We have our things. But we have to recognize and see if that's actually happening with us, with our devices, with our food, with our work, with drugs, with our sex. Are they clearing? Are they distracting? Are they turning us away? Are they overwhelming us with and that creating that paralysis? And can we sit like he did in that beautiful raw and just say, go ahead, just take me, just take me? I think this poem by Nazim Hikmet, it's on living. He's a Turkish poet. I've read some of his stuff before, and this came to mind from On Living. He says, this earth will grow cold, a star among stars, and one of the smallest, a gilded moat on blue velvet. I mean this, our great earth. The earth will grow cold one day, not like a block of ice or a dead cloud even, but like an empty walnut. It will roll along in pitch black space. You must grieve this right now. You have to feel this sorrow now, for the world must be loved this much if you're going to say, I lived. Our sages, our ancestor sages, our great ancestors maybe possibly couldn't imagine the world we live in today. But of course, they too are well acquainted with the kinds of human suffering and natural disasters that still concern us. Famine, disease, dislocations, losses and damages from war, the harms of how cruel we are to one another, the injustices. They know it. The wisdom traditions taught us about this guest house, how all world systems are born, rise, fall, come to an end. Yet, the Bodhisattva does not use that long view as a rationale to be indifferent, that this is what will be. But we don't use that to be indifferent and not care. We entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows. So yesterday I spoke in Zazenkai of the Buddha's last words, supposedly. I think there's several things that have been written as what the Buddha said on his deathbed. He was speaking quite a bit to his followers. He was. But one of them was, things fall apart, tread the path with care. But that was some of his last words. Things fall apart, so tread the path by caring, by taking care. Apamada, amapada, take good care. The protective commitment to what is good, guarding against those impulses and drives and habits of mind that seek to turn us away, that overwhelm us and distract us. So he said, take good care, guard what is good. Be fully conscious, be present. Be fully present in what guards the mind against what gives rise to troubles, to sufferings, to illnesses. Now, another example we have from history, when I went to the climate strike, we were walking with Ikkyo and we're like, how are all these people going to fit? And it reminded me of Vimala Kirti's living room and how like he's just got this living room, but thousands and thousands of bodhisattvas and devas and heavenly beings and all these beings were, he said, there's plenty of room in my living room. It just gets larger, right? And Sherry Pucha was all fatutzed about, do we have enough chairs? And at one point, Vimala Kirti turns to him and says, did you come here for a chair? Did you come here for a chair, Sherry Pucha? This is Shariputra. So, Vimala Kirti was a layman who said to have the realization, the equivalent of the Buddha. And he was at this one scene, if you picture the scene. So he's ill, okay? He's ill, and the Buddha is trying to persuade all his disciples who are top league, Manjushri, Shariputra, all the big Samantabhadra, like to go and meet Vimala Kirti and call upon him and ask him why he's ill. But they're all so freaked out. Like they know he's so cutting and clear that they don't want to go. They're reluctant bodhisattvas. They don't want to ask. So finally everyone kind of pushes Manjushri forward, the bodhisattva of wisdom, and he agrees despite how hesitant he is. So he asks Vimala Kirti about his illness, just like we do when a friend is ill, right? How are you doing? How long have you been sick? What's the treatment? How's it going? What's the prognosis? But Vimala Kirti gives a very unexpected answer. He declares that his illness is born of human ignorance and craving, that he's ill because Everyone's ill. That's his illness. Whoa. When all beings are free from suffering, his illness will be healed. Because bodhisattvas enter the realm of birth and death, they suffer illness. So how do we apprentice bodhisattvas undertake to care for all beings? And this is what Vimalakirti answers. How a bodhisattva should regard living beings, he replies, as the wise view the moon in the water, or a face or form seen in a mirror, as shimmers of heat in a torrid season, as the echo that follows a cry, as clouds in the sky, as foam on water, bubbles on water, no thing firmer than the trunk of a plantain, no longer lasting than a flash of lightning. But Manjushri's puzzled. If we regard living beings in this way, how can we treat them with loving kindness? Same thing as that question of knowing that things are fleeting and depending on that to not take care. And I've been asked this by a lot of people, particularly those who are parents. Am I supposed to be so not attached that I don't care about my child? How can I not care? So I found this poem by T.S. Eliot when it was at the end of World War I, in the despair of the post-war, he wrote these poems, and he was converting to Anglicanism, and he cried out, "Blessed sister, holy mother, spirit of the fountain, spirit of the garden, suffer us to mock ourselves with falsehood. Teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to sit still." He was seeking how to actualize his new faith, just as we do when we come to Dharma practice. There's so much more Vimalakirti said. I'll just give you, he teaches us how to care with the love of a bodhisattva, similar to Rumi's guest house. He treats living beings with a love that never despairs, seeing all is empty and without ego, treats them with the love of bestowal of the Dharma, never stinting in its gifts, treats them with the love of the observance of the precepts, training those who break them to do better, treats them with the love of forbearance, guarding both others and self. And it goes on and on. He's got a whole way to express our love and compassion. The Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, how should a bodhisattva go about comforting and instructing another bodhisattva who is ill? Tell him about impermanence of the body, but don't tell him to despise or turn away from the body. Tell them about the sufferings of the body, but tell them to strive for nirvana. Tell them that the body is without ego, but urge them to teach and guide living beings. Tell them of the emptiness of the body, but do not tell them of its final extinction. And that goes on and on. I don't want to put you to sleep. Like, I see you're fading. It could be a lot, but check out Vimalakirti. But Martin Luther King offered us this. There is something of a civil war going on within all our lives. There is a recalcitrant south of our soul revolting against the north of our soul. And there is this continual struggle within the very structure of every individual life. There is something within each of us that causes us to cry out with Goethe. There is enough stuff in me to make me both a gentle person and a rogue, a scoundrel. Enough in me to make me both. And often we may find ourselves, too, in the middle of Dr. King's Civil War, a bit of wakefulness and a really big chunk of delusion. In the shadowy depths of this would-be bodhisattva, this budding Buddha, there is someone who is reluctant to throw themselves in the house of the Buddha. So I will out myself secretly. I'd like to be safe and take it easy. All I've ever wanted was ease of my mind. But what kind of ease is this, we may ask? The ease and safety of the ease of safety and comfort, or the ease of Buddha's liberation? So many people write about this. Listen how Whitman would say it. I concentrate toward them that are nigh. I wait on the door slab. I concentrate toward them that are nigh. I wait on the door slab. Indeed. Soon we will chant, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them or awaken them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharmas are boundless. I vow to enter them, master them. The Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it, to become it. Because the bodhisattva vow cannot be attained. Numberless, inexhaustible, boundless, unattainable. This is language to inspire. The bodhisattva vows are vast. And some of us ask when we hear them, should I even make an effort? Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to say them. Out of here. Can't do it. I think of Greta Thunberg. I've listened to many of her interviews, and she speaks very candidly about how depressed she was, how she couldn't, she almost starved to death. She started to lose a lot of weight. And suddenly the thought arose in her mind. She could do something. She could do something for herself first, and she could offer herself medicine for her sickness, her illness, and the illness we were all suffering from. And so that motivation just grew stronger and stronger, as she did as well. So she had a motivation as a bodhisattva that was much stronger than her limited self-concept, who the being she thought she was, that she couldn't do anything for the pain she was feeling inside. You know, we chant, you know, may we be relieved from self-clinging. And we go, yeah, may I. Well, it's a radical commitment. So to make that commitment that we don't turn away, that we may we be relieved from self-clinging. This is Martin Luther King's The Civil War. Constantly drawing our attention away which might otherwise give us a great infusion to be so fully alive. The clearing out for some new delight. Somehow, the war has become the comfort zone. That's what we're shifting. Each time we release our greed, our anger, and our ignorance, we do become available for a greater purpose. To turn towards suffering, however reluctant we are, however long we might hesitate, just to keep turning. This is what and how a bodhisattva is, in weakness and in strength. Truly, truly being that human. Truly being that human. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.